Tassos presents the New York premiere of the award-winning playwright Jewel Gomez's Leaving the Blues. It's the story of the amazing singer Alberta Hunter. And we are thrilled to have Jewel Gomez join us in the studio. Jewel, great to see you, and thanks for being here at WBGO.
Thank you so much, Doug.
We're so excited about this play. Alberta Hunter, when her comeback came to the Cookery, so many people came to see her. And you were one of them.
I was one of them. I was thrilled. I think I saw her about 4 times. And each time it was inspiring, you know? Just she had such energy, such focus, such comic timing. She was great.
And it wasn't just her music and style that got you interested in Alberta Hunter. Tell us about when you were there and then you learned some things about her that you had heard rumors and you heard some things and this helped produce this show.
Yeah, it was a very exciting time to go there because it would always be packed. You had to make a reservation far in advance. And so my grandmother was coming to visit me from Boston, where I'm from, and when I lived in New York. And she had been a chorus girl. She danced on chorus line in the Black theater companies. And so she knew of Alberta. She had never danced with her, but she certainly knew of her. So I said, let's go, Nana, and see her. So we did. Place was packed. I said, Nana, you see all these young women in here. Why do you think they're here? She says, I don't know. I said, well, most of them came because they heard Alberta Hunter was a lesbian. And my grandmother says, oh, everybody knew that. And that was in the mid-80s. And from then on, I really wanted to write something about this amazing woman who had a kind of a hidden life. And an amazing career. And so I started doing research. After I did my earlier play in the trilogy, I started doing more research about her and realized she was somewhat secretive or unspoken about her life. And so there was a lot to discover and a lot to tell.
And you do it in Leaving the Blues. Once again, that's playing at the Flea Theater through February 8th. It stars Roz Brown as the wonderful singer Alberta Hunter.
I'm a plain little brown from a one-horse town, but I'm dancing just the same. I'm playing in my style with my big broad smile. Get the message I declaim. I went up on a mountain, looked down in the sea. The fishes in the water tried to flirt with me. I'm a plain little brown from a one-horse town, but I'm dancing just the same. I'm a plain little brown from a one-horse town, but I'm dancing just the same.
Before we get into the details of that, let's talk about this trilogy. The first one that that you had written was Waiting for Giovanni, and that's about author James Baldwin.
Yeah.
You pick some amazing people to write about.
Well, you know, it's as an artist, I'm always interested in how other artists survive, and particularly artists who are doing things that people don't necessarily want them to be doing. And I had a happenstance meeting with one of Baldwin's editors who talked about the difficulty Baldwin had when he wanted to publish Giovanni's Room. And I thought, it's hard to imagine James Baldwin being anxious, but I thought, I'll write a play about it. And his anxiety about should he publish a novel such as Giovanni's Room. So that was really the beginning, and I realized there's something about a period in the 1950s when I felt like African Americans had a lot of hope. A lot of activism was happening, but there was still hope that things could change in this country. So that led me to think about a group of plays about artists in the 1950s.
Talking about artists in that kind of time period And, you know, we just had the Academy Award-winning film Green Book come out about Don Shirley. So we know there's interest, right, and these and how these certain performers had to deal with all kinds of pressures and racism and whatnot. So it's a great time period to focus on.
It is. And when I saw the film, The Green Book, it reminded me of stories my grandmother had told me when she was dancing up and down the East Coast and having to know where she could stay and where she was allowed to be, where she could eat, where she could go to the bathroom. It was a very strange system, and yet those artists persisted in creating their art and sharing it with the public.
Our morning host, Gary Walker, who's been here for nearly all of the 40 years and 40-plus that this radio station has been around, well, he saw Don Shirley perform, but one person he didn't get to see live, and he regrets it to this day, was Alberta Hunter at the Cookery. What did he miss?
Well, it was, I didn't know what to expect because I had actually never heard her. I had heard of her. And the first thing you notice about her is her elegance. She would come on stage, and she was a little thing, very petite, and she'd be wearing like a beautiful long gown and a long scarf in her hand, perfect makeup, bright red lipstick. Her earrings were almost as big as she was. And she, when she smiled, she took in the entire room. And she would want to talk to you as if you were her children. And I loved that. She immediately put you at ease and immediately jumped into her singing. Once she started talking to you, she got your attention, and she started singing. She was as crisp and consummate a performer as anyone I've ever seen. And she was by then in her 80s. And ultimately, it became a little bit difficult for her to make the stairs in the Cookery, so she had to use everything on the same floor. She couldn't go downstairs to her dressing room, which, of course, I read about that part later. But going to see her, you would have never known she was frail in any way, because she was like a spark plug of energy. That was the biggest deal, I think, the energy that she conveyed and that crisp, professional way she sang, and the loving way she dressed the audience.
Now, the award-winning theater company Tasos, The Other Side of Silence, is producing this play this time around, but in 2017, a very special place for you is where this debuted.
Yeah, the New Conservatory Theater Company, which is in San Francisco, I'm the playwright in residence there. And they have commissioned Waiting for Giovanni, and they commissioned this piece and really helped me develop it. You know, work with me, have dramaturgs work with me to create a full story and figure out what's the best way to get a picture of the 1950s and African Americans and artists and still tell a story that's interesting and funny. Because the stories are funny, really. Because the sense of humor that people needed to get through those times was really important.
We're speaking with the amazing Jule Gomez, award-winning playwright, and of course the author of the Gilda stories. We'll get to that a little bit later. It took me that long to get to that, right? I did that on purpose, though, because you've done so much, and we don't like to sometimes just label you as this, you know, the author of the Gilda stories. But one thing about the Gilda stories and these plays that really attract me to them is the history. You are a lover of history, obviously, as your character in the Gilda stories goes through all stages of history, and you're able to just pinpoint the feelings of all those different eras. In this era with Alberta Hunter, she really has two different careers, doesn't she? She stops right in the middle of a career and goes into nursing, and tell us where Leaving the Blues starts off.
Leaving the Blues begins the day that she's retired from her nursing career. And the hospital where she works in New York City retires her because they think she's 65, but she's really more than 70. And trying to figure out, well, what is she going to do with her life? Because she's obviously got all this energy and she's a little bit despondent. And in my play, the ghost of a great vaudevillian comes back to her to kind of lead her through her past, back to her beginning almost, so that she can see what great work she's done and what she's accomplished, and that it's not over. It's not over till it's over, and it's not over. And then she makes her comeback at the end of the play, because her voice, her style, the songs are timeless, really.
I just happened to watch this morning in preparation for our interview her appearance on the Mike Douglas show when she made her career. And she just commanded the presence, and you couldn't hear a pin drop in that studio, the cameraman, everybody. You can tell that she had everybody in the palm of her hand.
And now at the age of 82, she's made a comeback. Here is Alberta Hunter. Welcome her, please.
That's the way she was as a performer, you know, in a club. And you know what nightclubs are like, and people are eating and drinking, and they were serving barbecue. But when Alberta opened her mouth, it was total attention and love, really. People loved her.
Roz Brown gets to play Alberta Hunter. How does that whole process work? Now, the show is directed by Mark Finley, but tell us, do you have any say in who gets to play her?
I had the good fortune to be invited by Mark to come to the auditions, and we saw some amazing performers. I have to say, there's an array of fabulous talents available to you when you're doing auditions on the East Coast, and Roz was one of the first people we saw, and I was blown away. I keep thinking, we will not need a microphone in this theater. Roz is so fabulous. Yes, a great voice, and really is able to pinpoint that kind of energy and professionalism. So Mark and I talk about the different people. You know, we had to have tap dancers. We talk about them and who would work with whom. And Mark is the person who decides. He made some fabulous choices. The cast is beautiful and really talented. So I feel lucky that I got to have a little part in getting a view of how it works, because it's all magical.
And not only is Roz familiar with, she's a native New Yorker, she was on Broadway for One More Time playing Thelma, then she played Wendy in Footloose, and has done a number of off-Broadway performances. You know, a question I have for you, Jewel, is how do you decide if you want to have a two-act play, three-act play, or just straight through with no intermission? Where does that come from?
Oh, gosh. It's determined, I think, by the work. You know, how complex is the story you want to tell? I originally started out with the Baldwin play, thinking it was going to be three acts. And then I thought, I don't really have that much to say. And I feel like people are more comfortable with two acts now, contemporary audiences. If I had a huge, expansive, sprawling story, maybe I would go to three acts. But I stick with the two. I've never really written anything that was short enough for a one act. And I think the it's the topic. Whatever the topic is will tell you how much time you're going to need.
When do you know, when you're looking at previews and you're looking at the cast, when do you know that it's, yes, that's what I wanted?
Well, I have a very strong feeling, usually before the dress rehearsal is over. Like tonight I'm going to see the dress rehearsal. Before the dress rehearsal is over, I can usually tell if they, the actors, have it. And it's not so much if they forget a line or don't forget a line or miss their mark or whatever. It's that energy. If the cast has that energy between them, you can feel it. I can tell, okay, this is going to work. This is really going to work. So I'll know tonight.
And we look forward to that. And we know that the play is going to be wonderful. Also, it's going to feature an original song by the world-renowned musician-composer Toshi Reagan. And people who have followed her career know how powerful she is. So to have a song from her, how did you work that in?
Well, Toshi was the main composer for my vampire musical about a couple of decades ago. And so I really wanted a song to finish this play off on an upbeat, you know, an upbeat blues number that pulled together the strains of the plot. So I wasn't really going to find that, I didn't think, in looking through all of the blues. But I thought of Toshi because she can write any kind of music you want. And right now, she's doing an opera based on an Octavia Butler novel, Parable of the Sower. So she can write anything. And I asked her and I said, this is what I'm looking for. These are the threads that I'm trying to pull together in a song. She wrote the perfect song that closes out the show.
How long did that conversation take between the two of you? two real artists getting together and deciding on something.
5 minutes.
I was going to say, probably didn't take that
didn't
long,
take
right?
Didn't take that long because we know each other's art. And, 5 minutes. And we worked together on the vampire musical based on the Gildersleeves for 3 years. So we really know each other's work.
We're speaking with Jewel Gomez about her play Leaving the Blues, making its New York debut and running at the Flea Theater through February 8th. The cast, it's a 8-person cast, I understand, right?
Yes, yes.
Want to talk about any of the other people involved?
Oh, my goodness. There's one of the actors, Joy Suddeth, was in Waiting for Giovanni. She played Lorraine Hansberry in Waiting for Giovanni, and that was the first time I had met her. And she's really extraordinary. She's a very compelling actress, and this part is very different from being Lorraine Hansberry. And she's got that magnetism that one needs. I mean, who could seduce Alberta Hunter? And Joy's got it going on. The other actors I hadn't really met before except for the auditions, and we've got two young men who are tap dancers, and I'm really thrilled. I can't wait to see them on stage with the new choreography and everything, because you don't get to see tap dancing on stage that much, certainly not in off-Broadway or off-off-Broadway. So these two young men are really quite exquisite.
I'm sure you have thought about this, but you just told the story earlier when we started the interview of how you were at the cookery seeing Alberta Hunter. You are a role model and icon to so many young women. It's kind of like it's come full circle, hasn't it?
Well, that's really kind of you to say. I feel like, you know, if you stay long enough, stay around long enough, people will start to remember you and respect you, one hopes. I feel very, very fortunate to have been raised by my great-grandmother and my grandmother. So I got to see what it means to grow old in a culture and really stay connected to the culture. And I think if you stay around, you stay connected, you keep doing your work long enough, younger people start to feel connected to you and start to gather lessons from you. And I certainly hope that's what happens with me.
With the Gilda story, it hasn't ended. It's continuing to grow, isn't it?
It is. It's very funny to have a novel. It just had its 27th anniversary.
Congratulations.
And it's been in print for 27 years. And, it, you know, it's still got lessons for people. Students and readers come up to me all the time wherever I go to do readings and tell me all the stuff that they've learned from this novel that some people just thought, why are you writing a vampire novel? Black people don't need a vampire novel. And that was 27 years ago. Now you can't swing a cat without finding a vampire novel. But Gilda still reigns. And Cheryl Dunier, who's a director, she's worked on Queen Sugar. She works on Claws. She bought the rights to turn the Gilda stories into a TV miniseries. So we're hoping that happens sometime in the near future. Yeah,
you know there's an audience for that.
I'm so hoping there is, because you know Gilda is a very fun character to write. I love writing her.
You also like to laugh from this interview, right?
Yes, I do. I do. And, you know, people find it hard to believe that I am. I'm very funny and tell jokes a lot. People who've read the Gilda stories, they expect a vampire writer to be kind of, you know, dour and goth. And that's not me. So I'm hoping the Gilda TV series works out. It's great fun. Again, Cheryl Dunier, how could I be so lucky? You know, she's such a wonderful director. So I'm looking forward to that process too.
Who's your favorite vampire? Can be current or past.
Oh gosh, my favorite vampire. It could be Catherine Deneuve. Could be her. Or it could be gosh, that film, it was an African-American director, and I'm going blank because you asked me.
But if you think about it, we'll come back to it if you think about it. When did you know that you had this talent to write? When did it start? Who gave you the first, yeah, this wasn't bad?
I always wanted to write ever since I was a little kid, and I would take out sheets of paper and sit down with a pencil, but I really couldn't figure out what to write. It was kind of like a blank. What would people want to read? Ganja and Hess. That was the vampire film that I saw that I really, really love. Ganja and Hess. Amazing. Anyway, so I later, when I got into college, I went to work, I was in Boston, and I went to work for WGBH, and a new show, one of the first African-American shows called Say Brother. This was in 1968. I was still in undergraduate school, and the producer of the show, named Ray Richardson, read, I said, please read this, but don't talk to me, because I was terrified. He said, okay. So he read it. He started to walk away. I said, wait. And he said, you didn't want me to talk to you. So I said, oh, okay, well, you can say something. And he said, this is really good. You're a writer. And I haven't stopped since, really. Really.
And have you relived that conversation?
No. But I think what happens through your lifetime, I think as a writer for me, you keep having similar encounters. When I went to see Endozaki Shange's For Colored Girls on stage, I remembered those blank sheets of paper from when I was a kid, and I realized, oh, right, I'll write about me. It's not about the other. If I tell my story, I'm telling a story that's going to have value to everyone. And so, again, it was that same aha moment that I had with Ray, I had with Entesaki Shange's play. Seeing Ganja and Hess, I realized, oh, right, gothic horror is a genre that could be of interest to people, and it can tell a moral. It can have a reason for being other than the scare you witless, you know.
I kind of like how, you know, you talked about when you were thinking about this that you didn't want to have a vampire who kills.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting.
It was a realization kind of halfway through the book, and my publisher at Firebrand Books, Nancy Bariano, was trying to help me edit it. And she said, you know, do you really want to write a novel about a serial killer? And I thought, oh, no, I don't. I really don't. So I, in the effort to figure out, well, how is it that she doesn't kill? Because she didn't have to kill. I mean, we give blood to the Red Cross, so, and we don't die. So it's entirely possible for that to be true. But I had to create some kind of method and reason that would make it interesting. So that's why she takes blood from people and leaves something in exchange, so that there's a quality to the blood exchange that's not just theft, you know.
We're speaking with author and playwright Jewel Gomez here on the WBJO Journal. We're talking about Leaving the Blues, which is making its New York premiere right now at the Flea Theater through February 8th. And for you, Jewel, when you think about Alberta Hunter, if you know, I like to ask this question a lot when you do plays about people that are real and that, you know, we're here. She steps into this studio today. What do you want her reaction to be about leaving the blues?
Oh gosh, that would be really scary, wouldn't it? I would want her to feel like I honored her. I honored her life. That I didn't embarrass her. I think she was kind of a private person, and I don't want her to feel like I embarrassed her, but that I honored everything she wanted to do. I mean, one of the great things that I read about her when I looked at her papers at the Schomburg, she made donations all the time. NAACP, the Y, when she would read an article about someone who'd had some bad luck in some, you know, Mississippi, she'd send them money. So she, in her own way, was a philanthropist, and I really like to honor that, her participation in our society, and I hope that she would feel that.
I guess when you're a nurse, you kind of have that inside you to begin with, right? You want to help people, you assume, right?
I assume, and one would hope, but it was so dear. You'd see in, among her papers an envelope with the list, NAACP, $50, the Y, $10, and it didn't matter how much money she was making, she always gave money to other people. And I felt this is a good example that we could take something away from that.
Do you have a favorite Alberta Hunter tune? That maybe capsulizes the Alberta Hunter you want us to know?
Oh, God, you know, she... Old-Fashioned Love was really, I loved hearing her sing that.
I've got that old-fashioned love in my heart. Oh, play it for me. Yes, and there it will always remain. My love is like an ivy vine, clinging a little closer all the time. Through the years, joy and tears, just the same.
And in fact, I have one of the character that she ends up with ask her to write me a song like Old-Fashioned Love, because that, I just feel like that is, it's a, not sentimental, but kind of gentle song about caring forever, loving forever.
When ideas pop into your head, do you have to write it down right away, or can you hold it in there?
Oh, no, I better write it down right away. My brain, you know, it just is too many things going on. I can't hold on to anything. Fortunately, you know, with these new iPhones, you can take notes forever. So I have folders and folders in my phone of ideas for different things.
How has social media and that impacted you?
Well, it didn't take me that long to catch on. I love Instagram because I love pictures, you know, images. It has been really fun because as I move around the country and I meet different people, I'm able to stay in contact with people either through Instagram or Facebook. And then I know people I don't see for a year. I can keep up with them. I really love that. Our family, who's all around the country, we can keep up with them through pictures and quick conversations. It has been really good, I think. I mean, I think a lot of people spend too much time on it, but I give myself a limit. I have little timers that tell me when to get off of Facebook.
Other than immediate family members, people who are close to you, who, if they showed up from your past to see this show, would bring tears to your eyes?
Well, if my grandmother could show up to see this show, I would be, you know, a basket case. I think I always honored her musical talent. She was always singing in the house, playing the piano. She taught me how to dance.
What type of dance? What was the first dance?
She tap dancing. She wanted me to learn how to do the time step, shuffle off to Buffalo. She would teach us in the kitchen on linoleum, which would be great. And it was very sweet. My great-grandmother taught me how to waltz, and my grandmother taught me how to tap dance. So, you know, that sense of music being part of your life, I really honored that. And so if she could come to see this play, she would be thrilled, I think, because it would bring so many memories back for her.
That's nice. Anything else that you'd like to tell us about the actual production of Leaving the Blues that maybe we haven't talked about? You mentioned working with director Mark Finley and the cast. Anything else that we should know about what it's like putting a show like this together?
Well, I would say I've been fortunate because Mark and I worked together before. I really appreciated what he did with the James Baldwin play. I think he's a brilliant director. He knows how to get to the heart of the story. And the theater is quite small, and so it doesn't have room for a lot of bits and pieces of things.
I love that.
Yeah, he just gets right at the core of that story. I really feel very fortunate to be able to work with him. And what you'll see when you come in is that the story is kind of broken open in this way, that as a director, he's able to do that. You know, with a writer, I'm going to decorate it with every piece I get of flotsam and jetsam I have in my mind. And he can cut through that and see where's the important parts. And that's what you get when you come in. And it's very, very emotional. I think the story is an emotional story.
The intimacy of a small theater. One of my very favorite performances was watching Frankie Faison talk about reparations in the small Luna Stage Theater in West Orange. And as he talked about slaves being laid together on the ship over, you felt that theater getting smaller and smaller. You could smell the blood. You could feel the sweat. I mean, it's powerful. And that's why I always love when I hear about, you know, the large theaters. And then you go on Broadway and you see amazing things too, like The Color Purple.
Yeah.
When Cynthia Erivo, my daughter had to see it four times.
Oh, wow.
She took me for my birthday and we sat down and she had just seen Hamilton. At intermission, and she loved Hamilton.
Yeah.
And she got to meet everybody in the cast outside, took her pictures and all that, like every Broadway fan wants to do, right? She looked at me and she said, "Dad, it's better. It's better than Hamilton." So, I mean,
There's another story about
you know, the Color Purple, and then, you know, she's starred in Harriet now.
Yeah.
She likes those history, you know, theme things. So who knows? She might be at your show.
She might be. Or maybe she'd like to play Gilda.
Wow. Now you're talking. Bing, right there is right. What a wonderful combination that would be. You're not done with this show, because Unpacking at P-Town is your third play in the trilogy. That's going to premiere in 2021. You're moving so fast, I can't. You got too many things going on.
Well, it's good, you know. You wait all your life to get this busy. You know, I remember the times I thought, oh, will anyone ever call me for work? You know, and so finally here I am. And Unpacking in P-Town, the third piece in the trilogy, is really about my grandmother, who had danced on the stage. And she had a group of friends who had also been performers, who had a cottage in Provincetown. And she would go down and visit them. And it was mostly gay men. And she would go and spend a month down there hanging out. And sometimes she would get my great-grandmother to put me on a bus and I could come down and spend the weekend. And so I would spend the weekend with all of these amazing singers and dancers and, you know, gay people living an out life. And she was the token straight girl because she was so gorgeous. Of course, they loved her. And it was a way that I got to see being gay in our culture was possible, and that the creativity that all of these people who were then, by then, in their 50s, all this creativity was still there. They still had that energy, the ideas. So Unpacking in P-Town is about this group of friends who are trying to figure out what's their next step going to be. And, you know, getting ready for the talent show in Provincetown, because, you know, there's always a talent show. So it's kind of got music in it, too, and some singing and a lot of laughing.
How important is it for you that the other side of silence is producing this play, is presenting this play, I should say?
That it's very important to me that Tosos has decided to do my work. I feel very lucky. It's very hard to find producers that are interested in your work, because it's very expensive to produce a play. It's very time-consuming. It takes up a lot of the resources. And it's uncertain whether they're going to get their investment back. And so I was really thrilled when they decided to do the Baldwin play. I think I'm doubly thrilled that they would come back and want to do a second play. It's pretty amazing.
They must have liked the first one.
And I wasn't too much of a pain in the neck, because, you know, playwrights can be a big pain in the neck. I feel it means everything to me in terms of my career, because it gives me the heart to go on to write the next piece. It's really difficult, I think, to imagine what you're going to write and there's nowhere for it to go. So I feel very lucky. And I lived in New York for 22 years. So this is a homecoming for me, and it's really lovely that Tosos has given me a home to come back to.
Do you have a message for the youth of today?
Oh, gosh. I really feel there's a lot of smart, sharp young people, and we underestimate them because we feel a little bit threatened by them. They don't have the same vocabulary we do or habits. But I would say stay focused on personal goals and social change goals, and you can't go wrong. If you can stay focused on those two things, you really can't go wrong, but you can't do one without the other, because it leads to unbalance. You got to have both of those goals.
Jewel Gomez is the author of 8 books, including the Lambda Award-winning classic The Gilda Stories, which has been in print, as she mentioned, since 1991. Her play Bones and Ash, based on The Gilda Stories, was commissioned by the Urban Bushwoman Company. Waiting for Giovanni was the first play in the trilogy, And then comes the one about Alberta Hunter that we've been talking about, Leaving the Blues, and then Unpacking at P-Town will be the third play in the trilogy. But Leaving the Blues is running at the Flea Theater through February 8th, being presented by Tassos. What an honor it is to have you here. I could talk to you for hours, but I know you have to get back.
Doug, thank you so much, and it's really a great pleasure to finally meet you and to be in BGO. I can't believe I'm in BGO.
You're
this
here, and we're thrilled you have been here, and come back.
Thank you. Thank you.